From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, UFOs in wartime with Mac Maloney, an incredible story. Get ready for that. And before we get into some of the events of the day, I do want to spend just a few moments to thank all of you for the very kind words about the passing of my father, who died on Friday. Your condolences, your emails were very much appreciated by my family and by me, and words will not ever express how important they were to us. And I just want to thank you for everything that you did to get us through a very, very difficult time. You know, you sometimes think you're prepared. You're always ready for something like that, even though Dad was 88 years old, and you really are not. But you made it a little easier for all of us, and I want to thank you for that. Here's what's happening. Something's going on in Iran. People really can't figure it out. There have been attacks on nuclear scientists and sites, leading some observers to believe that maybe, just maybe, the U.S. and Israel are trying to derail Iran's programs. At an Iranian military base, for example, 30 miles west of Tehran, engineers were working on weapons that the Armed Forces Chief of Staff said would give Israel a strong punch in the mouth. But then a huge explosion ripped through the Revolutionary Guards Corps base that was on November 12th, leveling most of the buildings. Government officials said 17 people were killed, including the founder of Iran's ballistic missile program. Iranian officials called the blast an accident, and perhaps it was. However, many former U.S. intelligence officials and Iranian experts believe that the explosion, the most destructive of at least two dozen unexplained blasts in the last 2 years, was part of a covert effort by the U.S., possibly Israel, to derail Iran's nuclear program and missile programs as well. We'll keep watching that story. New intelligence indicates, by the way, that North Korea is moving ahead with building its very first ROAD mobile intercontinental ballistic missile system. That's an easily hidden weapon capable of hitting the United States. The intelligence was revealed in a classified Capitol Hill briefing last month. Its existence was made public in a letter to Defense Secretary Leon Panetta from five House Republicans. William Forstchin is the professor of history and faculty fellow at the Montreat College in North Carolina. He has been on the program before. I want to get his take on this situation in Korea. William, welcome back. How are you?
Good evening, sir, and my condolences on the loss of your father. I recently went through the same thing. They were both members of the Greatest Generation.
Oh, they sure were.
And they didn't remember Pearl Harbor. They lived through it. Yep. And we are on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, at least here on the East Coast today.
I wanted to get your take of what's going on in North Korea now, and briefly this Iranian situation as well. You've had this incredible ability, William, to look at these world events and put them in perspective for us. First of all, North Korea, what's happening there?
North Korea, there was a bit of a confrontation in the Senate last month regarding some declassification of information. North Korea is moving towards developing a road mobile ICBM system, meaning not in a silo, but I would think if it's road mobile, it's a solid booster system that can be transported anywhere within North Korea, easily concealed, and launched with little, if any, warning. That gives North Korea a Pearl Harbor-like first strike capability of hitting the United States. They don't need hundreds of missiles as we did in the Cold War. All they need is three to lay down an EMP attack across the United States, which would be 1,000 times more devastating than Pearl Harbor Day.
And they probably would launch, wouldn't they?
Without doubt. We have a psychotic madman running that country. We have another... This is the equal of what Winston Churchill was trying to warn the world against in 1938. We are on the eve of a cataclysmic war. We can stop it before it starts. The world did not listen to Winston Churchill in 1938. Over 50 million would die as a result.
And this situation, William, in Iran, for example, if perhaps we are behind these blasts that have been occurring there, is that a smart thing as opposed to a full-scale war? Probably.
Iran has been preparing for years with vertical launch. Last time I was on with you, we were talking about how they're testing vertical launch out in the Caspian Sea off container ships. Again, to clarify, EMP, electromagnetic pulse weapon. All you need is one small to medium-sized fission bomb detonated above the Earth's atmosphere. It sets up an electromagnetic pulse, which anybody can look up on the Internet. It would blow out the entire power grid of the United States. According to a study several years back by a congressional committee on this, upwards of 90% of all Americans would be dead within a year.
Jeez. All right. I suspect something's happening on that end. I invite all of you to read William Forstchen's book, 1 Second After. Absolutely incredible reading there. Thank you, William. Scientists have developed a vaccine that protects mice against the deadly form of the Ebola virus. First identified in 1976, Ebola fever kills more than 90% of the people it infects. The researchers say that this is the first Ebola vaccine to remain viable long-term, and therefore, they say, can be successfully stockpiled. We shall see. Sediments drilled from beneath the Dead Sea reveal that this most remarkable piece of body of water all but disappeared 120,000 years ago. It's a discovery of high concern, saying scientists, because it demonstrates just how dry the Middle East can become during Earth's warm phases. A would-be saboteur, perhaps, arrested at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, made the claim that he was from the future. Eloy Cole, a strangely dressed young man, said that he had traveled back in time to prevent the LHC from destroying the world. The LHC successfully collected particles at record force earlier this week, a milestone that Mr. Cole was attempting to disrupt by stopping supplies, if you can believe this, of Mountain Dew to the experiment's vending machines. He also claimed responsibility for the infamous baguette sabotage in November last year. That's when a piece of bread fell down part of the tunnel. Mr. Cole was seized by Swiss police after CERN security guards spotted him rooting around in bins. He explained that he was looking for fuel for his time machine power unit, a device that resembled a kitchen blender. Well, NASA, of course, over the weekend announced that their planet-hunting Kepler spacecraft has confirmed the discovery of its first alien world in its host star's habitable zone, that just right range of distances that could allow liquid water to exist and maybe then life. Here's Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Stephen, this is exciting. It's a big planet. Nonetheless, though, it's Earth-like, isn't it?
Absolutely, George. And I, too, would like to express my sincere condolences on the passing of your father.
Thank you, Steve.
And in light of all this great scientific news that we're getting, this is a most amazing object. This object that we're calling Kepler-22b, just recently discovered and revealed to the world by the great Kepler telescope and Kepler mission. Here's an object, George, some 600 light years away, and we think that this might be one of the first confirmed type of Earth-like planets that's very much in what we call the habitable zone. And what's fascinating about this is the object's about 2.4 times the size of the Earth, and it goes around the parent star, like our sun, though a little cooler, every 290 days. So I think we're onto something here, George. Unfortunately, so far away.
All right, Stephen, my friend. Dr. Sky's website, drsky.com. Two black holes, the most massive ever, have been found by astronomers. The mass of each, about 10 billion times the mass of the sun. What does it all mean? Up next, physicist Michio Kaku joins us right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. As I mentioned, astronomers have discovered two black holes that are incredibly massive. But what does this all mean? Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, and also, of course, hosting various television shows, radio programs, and noted author, Physics of the Future. Here he is back on Coast AM. Dr. Kaku, how are you?
Very good, George.
Thank you, my friend. Now, what is the significance of this discovery of two massive-sized black holes that they've discovered?
Well, this is huge. You're talking about the 800-pound gorilla in outer space. It weighs up to 20 billion times the mass of our sun. Can you imagine having lunch and eating 20 billion stars? That's what this black hole has done. Two of them, in fact. It's about 10 times the size of the entire solar system. And we think that isolating these gigantic black holes will be able to answer one day the key question. And that is, if you fall into a black hole, where do you wind up?
Exactly.
Now, there is a theory. It's just a theory. It's controversial. That perhaps when you fall into a black hole, these 20 billion stars that fell into this black hole are shot out the other end. That there could be a white hole connected to this black hole, and it shoots out stars in the same way that this gigantic black hole eats stars for breakfast. And some people think that, doesn't that sound like the Big Bang?
It sure does.
Doesn't that sound like the Big Bang itself with a gigantic mass of stars spewing out? So, again, it's controversial, but there are physicists who take it seriously that perhaps even our universe was connected via a black hole in another universe.
And exactly, Mitchell, what determines then the size, the mass of these various black holes? Some are smaller, some are bigger. How come?
Well, they come in all sizes and shapes. First of all, you have two main types. You have stellar black holes. That is, an object maybe about 10 to 50 times more massive than our sun that collapses. And we see them in our own galaxy, wandering black holes, by the way. They could wander and catch up and gobble you up, and they wouldn't even burp. They're wandering black holes in the Milky Way galaxy the size of stars. Then we have galactic black holes. These are the monsters that we find lurking in the center of these galaxies. In fact, we think that the remnants of quasars. Quasars were gigantic baby galaxies that existed very close to the Big Bang, huge raging black holes, and we don't see them today. So we think that this could be a remnant of an ancient quasar that lit up the universe right after the Big Bang.
This is amazing, these wandering black holes. I mean, how fast do they travel?
Well, we've actually clocked them. By looking at old photographs, we can see the distortion of starlight, because, of course, you can't see them because they're invisible. But just like glass, moving glass can distort light so you can see glass, you can actually see the movement of the black hole as it goes across the stars. And we've been able to get the trajectory of these wandering black holes throughout the galaxy. So far, we've only found a handful of them, but they are potentially dangerous, and we think there could be hundreds of millions of wandering black holes in our own backyard that are very difficult to track because they are invisible and can catch up on you without any notice.
How close does an object have to be to a black hole like this in order to get sucked in?
If people ask the question, what about our own black hole in our own Milky Way galaxy? It weighs about 3 million times the mass of our sun. Why aren't we sucked into our own galaxy? Well, first of all, if you want to identify our own black hole in the center of our own galaxy, look in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. Sagittarius is the location of the center of the Milky Way galaxy. By rights, it should be a fireball. By rights, there should be a fireball that outshines the moon, in fact, that comes out every night. Unfortunately, we can't see it because of dust clouds. But at the very center, there's a black hole there. And we don't fall in because we orbit. We orbit around the black hole. We are outside what is called the event horizon, the point of no return. But anything that goes through the event horizon, this sphere surrounding the black hole, well, it's like a Roach Motel. Everything checks in, nothing checks out.
If you watched water go down a drain, Michio, is that the way a black hole theoretically would look if you could see it?
Somewhat. All black holes are rotating. In fact, we've clocked them at about 1,000,000 miles an hour. And that's very important because if you look at Einstein's equations and you put in a rotating black hole, you find that they collapse not to a dot but to a ring of neutrons that do not collapse because of centrifugal force. And if you fall through the ring, you fall through the wormhole into a white hole. So this white hole, we think, could be on the other side of a ring. So if you were to approach this gigantic black hole, first of all, you would see a black sphere about 10 times the size of our solar system. If you go through the black sphere, you would then approach the center where you would see a ring, a rotating ring of neutrons, spinning so fast that it doesn't collapse because of centrifugal force. And if you go through the ring, it would be like going through the looking glass of Alice. You'd be like putting your hand into another universe.
That's amazing. Now, if one of these wandering black holes approached our solar system, would it suck in like the far distant the planets first, or would it eat up the whole solar system in one bite?
Well, it depends on the angle at which it comes in. However, the first thing we would notice is that Pluto, Neptune, and Uranus are being distorted and shot into outer space. They'd be flung into outer space like candy. And then as the black hole got closer, it would start to probably gobble up gigantic planets like Jupiter because of the gravitational attraction. And eventually, it could literally swallow up our sun. Realize that these black holes are much more massive than our sun. Our sun, by the way, will not become a black hole because it's too small. It takes a giant star, maybe 50 times more massive than our sun, to become a black hole. But it would even eat up our sun.
That's
and
amazing.
This black hole has probably eaten up 20 billion suns. So it's had quite a feast over the last several billion years.
Kind of paint us a picture of what would happen to us on the planet as we got gobbled up by a black hole.
Well,
would it go all dark? What would happen?
Well, it wouldn't be pleasant at all. First of all, as the black hole got closer to us, it would fling the nearby planets like Mars. It would just throw them into outer space as if they were ping pong balls. And as we got closer, the gravity, the tidal forces would stretch us. This is called spaghettification. So our bodies would begin to stretch as our feet were attracted to the black hole faster than our head. And so we'd be strung out like a spaghetti as we got closer to the event horizon. And then time slows down. So as you get closer to the black hole, time in some sense even stops, according to the equations. So it's a tremendous distortion as you get closer and closer to the black hole. And as you go through the event horizon, you see all the light that's been trapped there for billions of years. So it's like going through your own album of your own history. You get to see pictures of the black hole forming billions of years ago because light has been trapped there for billions of years. So it's like seeing a videotape of the past as you get closer and closer toward the event horizon. So you would get massive distortions of space and time.
Are we puzzled by black holes?
Oh, yeah. There's a raging controversy with Stephen Hawking on one side and most quantum physicists on the other side.
And where would you be?
Well, I'm a quantum physicist, so okay. I would believe in something called string theory. I'm the co-founder of string field theory. And string theory is definitely a quantum theory. And because it is a quantum theory, it allows for quantum transitions to other universes. We call this the multiverse idea. So if our universe is a soap bubble and we live on the skin of an expanding soap bubble, then there are other soap bubbles out there. And perhaps when they collide or pinch baby soap bubbles, that's called the Big Bang. So the Big Bang itself may have been caused by the collision of two soap bubbles.
That's amazing. That really is. So these black holes could be portals to these other universes.
That's right. Again, it's controversial. We've never done it. It would be quite fatal for us to do an experiment of this nature. But you do wonder, where do all these billions and billions of stars go if they fall through the event horizon? And, you know, we have seen stars fall right into a black hole and seen the radiation that they emit as a consequence. These are black holes having lunch. And we can actually see the radiation emitted by these black holes as they fall, as stars, as they fall into the event horizon of a black hole.
How long does it take to fall into that and then just be gone entirely?
Well, from their own frame, that is, if you have a clock on the black hole itself,
yeah.
It only takes like a fraction of a second, a millisecond, to die. If you're from the outside looking in, it takes a long time because time is distorted. Time slows down as you get toward the black hole. For example, time beats faster on the moon than it does on the Earth, believe it or not. And we can measure this. Time beats slower on Jupiter than it does on the Earth. And time beats much slower on a black hole than it does on the Earth. And this is all because of Einstein's theory.
Fascinating.
Now, as you probably know, there was a challenge to Einstein 2 months ago when at CERN, experiments with the Large Hadron Collider indicated that neutrinos traveled faster than the speed of light. Well, we physicists had a heart attack when that result came out.
And apparently they did it again, and they found the same results,
That's right?
That's right.
They did it twice. 15,000 neutrinos traveled 60 feet faster over a distance of 454 miles. I mean, we broke out in a cold sweat when we heard these results. So we think that their result must be miscalibrated because of the GPS system. GPS is the weak link in their whole apparatus. There must be a miscalibration, or else Einstein is wrong, and all hell breaks loose.
You got that right. Michio, stay with us. We're going to come back with more. We'll take some phone calls as well with Dr. Michio Kaku right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we are well into December with our goal now of 2,000 new members for the Coast Insiders Club, and you can be too for less than 25 cents a day. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com, and you can fill out the information. Also, on our highlight reel tonight, we made it very easy for you. You can just click that, too. You'll see that right there when you go to coasttocoastam.com when you want to become a member of the Coast Insiders Club. When we come back with Dr. Michio Kaku, we'll take your phone calls as we talk about all things physics on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Dr. Michio Kaku this hour. Michio, I bet as a professor, your students are spellbound by your courses.
Well, I'd like to think so. No. We have student surveys. I teach astronomy, and I have like 600 kids that are really thirsting to understand our universe.
This discovery by Kepler of the another Earth-like type planet, this one in the habitable zone. But then they were saying that they tried to throw in this little curveball that maybe it's too big to do what it has to do. Why would that be an issue?
Well, first of all, this is the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail of astronomy is to find twins of the Earth orbiting other stars. And last week was a banner year. We found not one, but two Earth-like twins in the Goldilocks zone. Not too close, not too far from the mother star. Gliese 351e and Kepler 22b, as you mentioned. However, if the planet is much, much too large, then its atmosphere is not going to be Earth-like. Take a look at Jupiter. Jupiter has a hydrogen atmosphere because it is so massive that it can even cling on to ancient hydrogen gas from the original solar system. So if a planet is too big, then the atmosphere will contain a lot more than just oxygen and carbon dioxide and chemicals that foster life. So you need to have a planet, first of all, in the Goldilocks zone, so we have liquid water, liquid oceans, because that's the universal solvent out of which DNA first got off the ground. And you don't want it too big, because then the atmosphere has all sorts of different kinds of gases, not just carbon dioxide, oxygen, and nitrogen.
You know, this story about this individual that said he was a time traveler going back to try to disrupt CERN. You're a believer in time travel, but is it possible it's happening?
Well, I think I know the origin of this. One of my colleagues is Professor Hagen Nielsen. He's a very well-respected physicist, and he wrote a paper, kind of tongue-in-cheek, stating that maybe all the woes of the Large Hadron Collider came from a time traveler from the future who wants to prevent the Large Hadron Collider from being turned on. I know Hagen Nielsen. He's a real physicist, but he's also kind of a practical joker. So I think this guy latched onto this paper written by a reputable physicist and said, I am the time traveler. I have come back from the future to warn you about the Large Hadron Collider.
By grabbing Mountain Dew and throwing it in a kitchen blender.
Yeah. Well, you have to realize, first of all, that the Large Hadron Collider is a pea shooter. A pea shooter compared to what Mother Nature can whip up with cosmic rays in outer space. The Earth is hit with particles much more energetic than anything this puny pea shooter can make, called the Large Hadron Collider. Now, we think it's huge because by human standards, it's gigantic. But by nature's standards, nature laughs when nature considers how small the Large Hadron Collider is. Nature can slam two black holes together and create radiation far beyond anything that we can muster on the planet Earth. And the Earth is still here for billions of years.
Well, that's an incredible story. Let's take some calls while we chat. Michio, this hour is going to go by way too fast. Mike is in Seattle, Washington, and on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Michael.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of yours, George, and yours as well, Dr. Kaku. Dr. Kaku, I just wanted to throw out my equation. Basically, you've written in the past that you believe that the theory of everything would be, you know, shorter than an inch, and similar to Einstein's relativity theory of E equals MC squared. Well, basically, what if in like quantum theory, where every things are influenced by consciousness and observation, and basically, my equation is 1 is equal to infinity, where all it really takes is one consciousness, and everything is possible. Your comment, I'll take it off the air.
Okay. Well, first of all, for people who want to know more about the possibility of a one-inch equation that would allow us to read the mind of God, go to my website. It's mkaku.org, and I have a series of articles about Einstein's dream of finding this one-inch equation. Now, we have to realize that one-inch equation has to be packed with information. E equals mc squared is deceptively simple because it contains energy, mass, and shows how mass can turn to energy in stars. In fact, that is the secret of the stars. That's why stars shine. However, an equation of everything has to include protons, neutrons, electrons, quarks, all the subatomic particles. And you may say to yourself, well, that's impossible. How can you include these thousands of subparticles in an equation 1 inch long? Well, the answer probably is string theory, because a violin string can be represented by an equation 1 inch long, and its vibrations can correspond to electrons, protons, neutrons, quarks, Yang-Mills particles, and gluons. And so that's a very simple way in which you can summarize thousands of subatomic particles by assuming that music is the language of the universe, and the mind of God is cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace.
Michio, if life is teeming in the universe, and this universe is about 14 billion years old, can we assume just by the model of us that life will form around 4.5 billion years? It would take that long to get to our point where we are now, and that, therefore, if the universe is 14 billion years old, that it's possible that there could be civilizations that are 10 billion years older than us, assuming they've survived.
That's right. We are a type zero civilization. We get our energy from dead plants, and we're quite primitive. Type one would be planetary. Type two would be stellar. Type three would be galactic. And it would only take a few thousand years to go from type one to a type three civilization like the Empire of the Empire Strikes Back in Star Wars. And so once you attain type one status, that is planetary status, you can go up the scale very fast. And so it would only take thousands of years for us to attain the technology that you see in Star Trek or in Star Wars. And the universe, as you pointed out, is billions of years old. 13.7 is the latest number I saw. And so there's plenty of time for Type 2, Type 3 civilizations to have flourished in our galaxy.
Can you imagine that? Just the knowledge they would possess by being that far advanced from where we are.
Yes, and they would probably have a very sophisticated way of exploring the galaxy. They probably would do it using robots that are like in probes that land on a moon and create carbon copies of themselves, thousands of copies of themselves, which then shoot out to other moons and create more carbon copies of themselves. And like a virus, one virus can create 100 viruses, and the next generation, 1,000, the next generation, 1,000,000, then 1,000,000,000 viruses. That's the easiest way for a Type 3 civilization to colonize our galaxy. So in other words, on our own moon, we physicists have speculated that maybe there is a remnant of a probe left over from a passing Type 3 civilization waiting for us to make contact with it. But we are too primitive to create a moon base capable of finding such a probe. That, of course, is the basis of the movie 2001. So that movie, 2001, when you watch it carefully, is actually probably the most realistic encounter with an alien civilization right in our own backyard, and we're too primitive to notice it.
All right, let's go to West Hartford, Connecticut. Bill, it's your turn, the astronomer with us. Go ahead, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi, Dr. Kaku. Hi, I've been wanting to talk to you for years. I am an amateur astronomer and an atheist myself, and I'm glad you mentioned string theory in a call or two ago, because I want to ask you a question that I asked Dr. Brian Green as well as Dr. Leonard Mlodinow now, and I wanted to get your take on it also, that relates something that you probably have never thought of, and that is string theory to the human brain, string theory to consciousness, string theory to the mind. Now, saying it very briefly, if all matter, all atoms, parts of atoms break down to strings, then our bodies, and in this case, our brain, breaks down to strings. So my question specifically is, as an atheist myself, this is a non-religious answer to existence after death without invoking heaven or hell or God. Could the sum total of all the trillions upon trillions of strings that could or would make up the chemical composition, physical composition of our brains exist as an energy field in either another dimension, an energy dimension or an energy universe in which religious people wrongly and misguidedly call heaven or hell without the need of a God either?
Well, you ask a very deep question. First of all, we think that the universe is a symphony of tiny little vibrating strings. Our bodies consist of electrons and neutrons and protons. Each particle is nothing but a rubber band vibrating at a certain frequency. So physics is nothing but the laws of harmonies of these vibrating strings. Chemistry is nothing but the melodies you can play on these strings. And the mind of God that I mentioned would be cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace. Now, because it is hyperspace, these strings are not ordinary strings. They don't vibrate in three dimensions. They vibrate in 10 and 11-dimensional hyperspace. Now, some people, theologians, once thought that maybe God lives in a higher dimension. Maybe God is so powerful that three dimensions is too small for him. Maybe he lives in four or five, six dimensions. And so at the turn of the last century, around 1900, several theologians came out and said that God exists in hyperspace, that only hyperspace is big enough to accommodate a God that is omnipotent and omniscient. Well, that theory never went anywhere because, of course, there was no evidence to back it up. But now we have string theory, and we're going to test it with the Large Hadron Collider. We hope to find sparticles with the Large Hadron Collider, superparticles, particles that are predicted by string theory, which represent the next octave of tiny little vibrating aura bands. So, well, who knows? Some people think that maybe ghosts and demons can exist in higher dimensions. I take no position on that. I just mentioned that historically, many theologians have written treatises and articles about the fact that maybe spiritual beings can exist in higher dimensions.
Michio, you're one of the busiest physicists I know. What are you working on now these days?
Well, right now, I'm working with the Science Channel and the Discovery Channel. There's a new series coming out called How the Universe Works, Season 2. So I'll be on that. So watch for it on the Discovery Channel. And right now, I'm appearing in Prophets of Science Fiction on the Science Channel. And my book, Physics of the Future, may eventually become a TV series. It's a New York Times bestseller. Amazon just chose it as one of the 100 best books of all categories for the year 2011.
Good for you. Let's go to Alyssa in Katona, New York. Welcome to the program, Alyssa.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick statement and a question. The statement is what you described as what may happen if we fell into a black hole sounds very much like what people who have died and come back describe. They say suspension of time, going through a spinning vortex of light, and some of them talk about heaven at the other end, and being reluctant to have to come back. So I don't know, that similarity seems really obvious the way you described it. I was wondering kind of what your take on that was. But my main question is, I'm in the market. I want to buy an inexpensive telescope, hopefully a couple hundred dollars, but I want to, something decent that I can at least, get a better look at the, closer planets and, whatever else would be nice. But I really don't know anything about what sort of specs or what sort of features or, refractor numbers I should be looking for. Could you give me some advice on that?
First of all, the first thing you should do is buy binoculars, because so many people have visions of seeing sand dunes on the surface of Mars. Not going to happen. And it's kind of discouraging that you will see the moon, you will see some planets, but the stars are just pinpoints. So first, get a pair of binoculars just to see whether you like it, because it does take certain dedication. Then if you do buy a telescope, don't get a toy. You're going to be wasting your money buying something something that is smaller than like a 4-inch reflector. So if you are pretty serious, you should go for a reflecting telescope. It looks like a tube. And now they have automation so that you can push a button and it automatically zeroes in on Mars and Jupiter and Saturn. You don't have to search the heavens late at night. You just push a button. So you may want to get a reflecting telescope, let's say 4 inches or larger, and get one that has a mount that is computer guided so that you will always be able to lock on to celestial objects without any of the guesswork of previous generations of telescopes.
Oh, that's exciting.
Okay, thank you. That sounds great.
Mm-hmm. That is exciting. What does it work on, like a GPS system? How does that work?
Yeah, the different kinds of modes, but GPS is one way that the system can work. Also, by the way, they also have telescopes that allow you to jack into telescopes around the world so that you, by pushing buttons, can actually manipulate by remote control a telescope on the other side of the Earth.
That's amazing.
Right. So you can actually see the stars in the southern hemisphere and control the telescope. So there are, in fact, some amateurs who allow their telescopes to be guided by people on the web so that they can, on a cloudy day, still get a bright view of the night sky because it's nice where the telescope is located. And it's all done by the Internet.
These neutrinos that you mentioned that are going on at CERN, where mm-hmm. they have now done the experiment twice and it's corroborated each other, where they say these little particles are faster than the speed of light. What does that mean if this is indeed true?
If it's true, all hell breaks loose. First of all, time travel would become easy because if you can break the light barrier effortlessly, like with neutrinos, it means you can go backwards in time. We would have to recalibrate the GPS, recalibrate the age of the universe, the age of stars. It's a mess. We would have to recalibrate laser beams, recalibrate hydrogen warheads. All of it is based on the speed of light. And if we have to modify the speed of light or modify Einstein's equations, then all of modern physics falls apart. So we physicists, most of us, believe that the mistake was made in the GPS system. We know the distance between Switzerland and Italy to be 454 miles in this experiment because of the GPS. But the GPS is a relativistic system. So you're using relativity to defeat relativity. And there's something circular about that. So most of us think that they did not measure the distance correctly. That is the 454 miles between Geneva, Switzerland, and part of Italy.
Are they going to try to do it again?
Well, it's going to be duplicated in Japan and also in the United States.
Okay. Now, if it's backed up in these other locations, then, as you said, it's all going to break loose.
Yeah, that's right. There are no sacred cows in physics. Just because somebody's famous doesn't mean you have to believe what he says. Physics is not like religion or politics. Every theory has to match the data every single time. One data point will kill an entire theory. In fact, in the 1930s, the Nazis published a big book, 100 Authorities Denouncing Einstein's Theory of Relativity. And Einstein joked that you don't need 100 authorities to defeat relativity. You just need one fact, and that will collapse relativity.
That's amazing. And what is a neutrino?
A neutrino is a subatomic particle that's quite elusive. Your body is being hit by millions of neutrinos from the sun on the other side of the Earth. If the solar system were made out of solid lead, the neutrinos would go right through the entire solar system. That's how penetrating they are. They go right through the Earth. They would go right through stars. And they apparently go faster than the speed of light in this experiment.
Dr. Kaku's website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Michio, anything you need, you get a hold of us, okay, my friend?
Okay,
And you have a great holiday. Dr. Michio Kaku. And his book, Physics of the Future, and he's got some great television shows out there as well. When we come back in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM, UFOs in wartime, what they didn't want you to know, Mac Maloney joins us. It's an incredible story, in some cases, shocking accounts of UFOs observed during times of conflict as well. So get ready, sit back, and enjoy that program. On Coast to Coast AM, I will be right back. Don't touch your dial.